Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. My name is Barney Hoskins, and I'm in downtown Hammersmith with Mr. Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Mr. Jasper Mirison Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
Proximity effect.
We're here to talk about all that's new in the world's largest archive of music journalism. And joining us for this episode is Mr. Cliff Jones, journalist turned pop star, turned lecturer, turned fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, no less. Welcome, yeah. Cliff.
Hello. Hello, Barney. Hello, all. Nice to be here. Fellow. Privileged to be invited into this hallowed library of... Yeah. basically, it's my life. In the
this is your life.
This is my life. Yeah.
This is your life. We're going to ask you, Cliff, about your writing, about your former band Gay Dad, of course, and about your work with BIM, the British and Irish Modern Music Institute.
Actually, we're a university now. We're BIM University. We've just been awarded university status.
So great BIM start. University is huge.
Yeah, yeah, well, everyone's been called university these days. Yeah,
you were doing well up to that point.
We're also going to talk about another Jones, Mr. Brian Jones. We'll hear clips from the week's new audio interview, which is with Paul Simon. And we'll be saying goodbye to Rocks Back Pages contributor Pete Silverton. But let's start with, indulge me, my first memories of you, Cliff, coming into the Mojo office circa 1994 in an old sheepskin coat, a white sheepskin coat, and just being very, very entertaining. He was a breath of fresh air. Do you remember coming into the Mojo office in 1994?
I do, because I'd been doing some work for Melody Maker, and that was going quite well. And I was also writing for The Face, so I had a bit of, you know, I had a
bit of kudos.
Yeah, a bit of kudos. It's like, okay, yeah. Well, but for me, the people in that room, when I walked in, they were all the people I was going, right, you're the people that really write about the stuff that I enjoy.
Right.
And so it was quite, I'm not going to say terrifying, but it was slightly, okay, you're going to have to watch yourself here, because these people, like, you know, they might bat you away like a fly. So I'd already worked with Paul Trinker, who was just beginning to work at Mojo at that point. An amazing editor, amazing mentor for me, basically corralled me. And I think that really helped, because I thought, well, you know, if I've interviewed Brian Ferry, I deserve to be in the room. but it was a bit like that, because these were all people that I've read, and it was a kind of journalism that sort of mainstream, you know, the smash hits didn't really do. It was detailed, it looked and recontextualized stuff, and it just made a lot of sense to me. And a lot of stuff being written at that point was starting to review the world and all the influences that I'd drawn on. And so every issue was just jam-packed full of stuff like, oh, my God, that record, and that's being reissued, and they've written a piece about these people. And so it was a bit awe-inspiring to be in that room. And
well,
you were all great,
actually.
Actually,
we were inspiring awe. No, what I remember actually is you being very, very entertaining. You know,
what do you mean by that, Bonnie?
No, you just, well, we always looked forward to you coming by, because we knew we'd just have a tremendous laugh with you, and you were so enthusiastic and so full of energy.
Yeah.
And it's quite a daunting thing, as you say, to walk into. I mean, my first, like, you know, visits to the NME, walking to the NME, absolutely shitting myself, you know. And everyone would say the same thing. You know, I realised it at the time. But you really sort of pulled it off. And
phew.
Well, yeah, we look forward to, oh, Cliff's coming in. And I mean, I think Jim Irvin who was the feature editor, was your probably point of contact, wasn't he?
Yeah, because, I mean, I've been reading Jim for a long time. I'm a real studier of bylines and people's names. And because I really identified with different styles of writing. So when I saw Jim had a particular style, you've got a very particular style. When Matt wrote, Matt had a very particular style, and so on and so forth. So, and all the contributors that I knew, some of which were obviously based abroad and were just sort of legends from the Cream era, I was just going, right, okay. These were all definite styles. And it for me, it was that idea of each of these journalists has earned the right to be in that space, and they've all got a particular take on the cult, on music culture. And I was probably much more interested in their writing styles and their take than I was on the music necessarily. Music I already had an opinion on, but the writing. So Jim had a particular way. It was sort of very understated, and he was very focused on, I mean, I remember, you know, amazing pieces that he wrote. He wrote an amazing feature on, Sandy Denny piece was incredible.
It was sort of like my real introduction to Sandy Denny. Yeah. I mean, I obviously knew she was, but it was Jim who really made me go and listen to all the solo work.
So
I owe him a lot. Yeah. And obviously, he was a great champion of Jeff Buckley's at the time. I remember you talking about this band, and you had a name for it, and in a way, it started with a name, didn't it? There's that we're adding this, we're running this NME interview with you by Johnny Cigarettes,
and which I reread. Somewhere
it says it started with a name, and Gay Dad was a name before almost before anything else, wasn't it? It seemed just like a concept that you had.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe now because I'm not sure the name's aged that well. Although it may be coming back into, you know, it goes through waves, that name. But in my mind, and this may connect with your sort of perception of me as sort of quite enthusiastic, you know, like a sort of eager Labrador, I suppose, back in those days.
The Labrador's in reception. Let him in.
I know what really happened, Barney. It was like, oh, God, who's going to talk to him today? what ideas he got today? But, yeah, no, it did start with a name. But that name, I mean, the history of the band is not as it's been written. And I perfectly accept that the written version of my life and the band and everything that happened around us is created by the public. It's one of the things you learn as a writer, is that the mythos around you is created by other people. Just as the hits that you have are not yours, they're made by the public. Somebody decides they like your record and they want to tell somebody else about it. It's much more sort of reciprocal relationship, I think. And that name and the story that emerged around that was all, you know, ours. It's not been written about properly, you know, thankfully.
When's the Mojo Gay Dad special?
yeah, you know, what's it? You know, they're playing some of your past on the radio on the, you know, Where Are They Now thing.
A
footnote in the annals of rock, as Julian Cope once memorably said, you know, about Bill Drummond, I think.
Well, you say in that Johnny Cigarettes interview, I'm determined for Gay Dad not to be a footnote in the annals of rock.
Yeah.
So you cite that.
Well, you know, I when you get into the arena of, you know, the public space, it's a lot more gladiatorial than you expect.
Yeah.
And I obviously in my naivety thought, hey, people are going to ride this train with me, it's going to be great because we'll all have a crazy time and it'll be fun, and not everybody wanted that. But the point is, looping back to the point, is that tangents to tangents, is that the whole thing for me is a really different story, but I love the version that's out there in the world. It's incorrect from my perspective, but it is a story and there's a mythos around it. And I'm happy that I'm even have a kind of loose mythos.
Yeah, until it gets flattened by ChatGPT.
Hey, but by the way, I did this the other day. You should all try this.
Well, Mark's tried it. Yeah.
It's crazy, right?
It's actually a pack of lies.
I had a comeback album in 2011, apparently, and I've been touring the world ever since.
Right, so that's now the official version
of my life.
And Carl Blake, who used to be in the Lem Kittens, he discovered he died in 2014 when
oh, God.
That's dark, right, isn't it?
I'm dead. Apparently, I'm dead.
But so where did the name Gay Dad come from?
We've never told anyone, really. We used to tell people all sorts of things. We say we bought it at an auction, internet auction, and early days of the internet. Anything that sort of passed through our heads on that day.
Did you know a Gay Dad?
Yes. I'll tell you, I mean, here's a good story. This happened just before we got signed. I mean, the name Gay Dad had been around a long, long time. I mean, when I was living in Clapham, and we were, I mean, there were several incarnations. It's ridiculous, but the seeds of the band started out as the Astral Projection Society, which I always thought was quite a good name. We were just like 14-year-old kids in paisley shirts and sort of winkle pickers and very into sort of, you know, acid fuzz guitar from the 60s, you know, very influenced by sort of garage.
And that's what I was getting from you when you would come in and talk about
psych, folk psych, you know, all of that stuff.
Mellow Candle.
Didn't you bring in a Mellow Candle?
I did, yeah. I mean, at one point we were going to, we had an offshoot, well, there were two offshoot bands. There's one called Scooby Government that was a kind of agit-pop, political kind of
political wing of
proto-Marxist flipping we're naive kids, we don't know what we're doing. And then there was the other side of that, which was a sort of folk, there was a sort of folky incarnation. And the very first thing that we ever did was very folky, and that was where I met Andrew Lou Goldham and Tony Calder, and that's a funny. I'm not sure how much of that I can say on
well, you described them coming to see you in that yeah. NME piece.
Oh,
so
right,
you get
okay.
a sense of, I mean, you say that Andrew had flown in directly from Bogota
to see
you.
Brilliant, brilliant story. I sat on the edge. I was absolutely terrified because I knew that he had a reputation as being, you know, interested in people of all kinds, let's put it that way. And I remember being summoned to this hotel in Victoria, bearing in mind that I knew quite a bit about him because he was a real Svengali figure.
Very.
Been terribly misportrayed in the whole story of particularly the Stones, I think. And it was interesting because that loops back to this Broomfield documentary. But he was an extraordinary man, absolutely extraordinary, one of the legends, as was Tony Calder.
Right.
Tony Calder and him together were just this incredible business duo. They were buccaneers, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
absolute buccaneers. You were aware you were in the presence of pirates. You better watch out, you know. They were a bit like that.
Yar.
But I was summoned to this hotel room, and he said, "We want to sign you. We're going to sign you. We're going to sign your band."
What at that point? To just them.
I can't even remember. Right. I've got the contract somewhere.
Okay.
The contract's amazing because it says territory, the known universe, brackets. Except White Hart Lane, close brackets. And for not inconsiderable sum of money.
That's brilliant.
But they were just nuts. They were crazy. They didn't care. By the way, if you want a book to read, the book that they co-wrote on ABBA is extraordinary.
I have read bits of it. It's so fucking weird. It's
so weird. Anyway, back to the action.
that's a good tangent.
I'm sitting there on the edge of this bed in fear of my... you know, my life, really. But bathing in this man's incredible kind of aura, very charismatic man, extraordinary man. And he sort of got this thing out from the bedside drawer next to the Gideon's Bible and took a Stanley knife out from, I don't know where he got it from, just like chipping bits off it, off this ball.
Off the Bible?
Off this ball of this white cricket ball, not cricket ball, it was a golf ball sized of something. And I stared, it's just... Okay, well...
It was a Colombian golf ball.
It was a Colombian golf ball.
Let's just say that.
A tightless Colombian golf ball, Colombian special. I just... you've only been in the country 2 days. He was wearing this incredible tweed coat, and he just showed me. He said, "My wife is an accomplished seamstress." And there's a little pocket. It's sewn under the armpit.
Fantastic.
Not a word of a lie. I don't know how much we can say about that.
That absolutely essentially has to go in. No, it does. it explains his change of location, doesn't it? But how does he?
He's still alive, and he probably is litigious. So we should probably. Be...
How does he square all this with his Scientology? Because he's still a Scientologist, isn't he?
I don't know anymore.
I mean, he's definitely not. Smuggling substances into the country. I know that for a fact.
This was 1992.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He'll probably write about it in his next book. So,
yeah. Exactly. You know. I mean, yeah. Look,
I think he's a limitation.
He's not shy about it.
I think he's no stranger to the thing. Anyway,
no, I wouldn't worry.
But they were, you know, they funded a recording session. We recorded down at some studio called Chapel Lane in rural Wales, where they recorded Ebony and Ivory. And I used to think, it's like, you know, everywhere you went in that town, it was like, you know, how do you get here? And they go, turn left, turn right, it's behind the cattle market, mate. And you go there, and I thought, it's Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney walking through this weird village.
Asking for directions,
you know.
Producing the worst piece of music I've ever produced in their entire career. Yes.
Paul McCartney is notoriously litigious. And I don't know about my
guys. That's a statement of opinion.
That led to a sort of regrouping of the band. That the original singer left and he walked out. We did a gig, I think, at the Orange in Fulham at some point, and he said a few things to. I'd invited all my hip friends from The Face, and he said a few things at that gig, and I thought, well, this isn't going to go well, because they all turned up, walked out. You know how, like, really cool people are?
Yeah.
It's like, this is over. And we regrouped, and I remember just before Christmas, we had a recording session booked, and it was either the end of the band or it was going to be the band, and I just thought, well, I'll sing.
You sang, yeah.
So we sang.
And you didn't even know you could sing.
I didn't even know I could sing. Many would say that I can't sing. But I do. In my own fashion, I do sing. But that's cool. Here is this rule. To us when we So that was that. And we knew, as we put the thing down, we knew.
And the aforementioned Jim Irvin had, of course, played a role in this.
Yeah, that's incorrect in the article. It says it was produced by Jim Irvin. It wasn't produced by Jim.
He produced a demo, didn't he? No. Did he work on a demo with you?
He did. Oh, yeah, no, he produced the Andrew Lou Goldham sessions.
Okay, fine. Got it.
The ones that led to us getting signed were produced by me, the band.
Okay.
And an engineer.
So we're correcting footnotes as we go along. This is the value.
The caveat here, Barney, is that these are my footnotes.
Well,
and they're not necessarily the footnotes of the world, right?
The Rashomon history of rock and roll. There you go. I was there. No, you weren't. I played bass on that. No, you didn't.
Well, you know, that's why I got sued by Pink Floyd for the book that I wrote.
Claiming that you were on Wish You Were Here?
Yeah, no. Claiming the royalties. Yeah, I did the synth on that. No, but that's why I got sued, is that there were some things that were
inaccurate.
Yeah, inaccurate in there that I'd got from sort of recording engineers and people like that. So,
gosh.
Again.
Well, Sid was one of the big pieces you wrote for Mojo. You wrote a handful. We have some of them on RBP.
These
pretty sort of epic pieces for Mojo, and we've got the Syd Barrett one, we've got the Steve Marriott one, and a Peter Green one. Those are the three longest pieces. We're actually featuring on the homepage, just so people know, is an early piece you wrote for the first magazine you wrote for, International Musician. And
the Talk Talk one.
Yeah, that's quite sort of techie. Talk Talk.
Yeah.
And then there's a face piece about the Fugees, which I remember from the time because I love the score so much.
Yeah, it's amazing records, and they were that. I'm really pleased you picked that one
because
I reread
great.
It. I haven't read it since I did it, but I reread it and thought, actually, you weren't bad.
You weren't bad. No, you're right,
and it really moved me to bearing in mind what's happened to them.
Yeah,
but you can see the seeds of everything in that piece,
right?
And it's
posted that in the first place.
Yes.
I went to see Lauryn Hill at Grant Park, Chicago in 2005 or something like that, and she didn't show, inevitably.
I saw a pretty great solo show after Miss Education at Madison Square Garden in 99.
Yeah.
She was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
She became really unglued in a variety of ways.
Not long
it's
after
very sad.
That.
I think, you know, it's because, you know, if you look into her, the socio-political origins of that band, of that group of people, and you've also got the sort of connection to the Panthers and her early life, you can see the tension is there. It's not only a tension between the sort of secular and the religious, which was in that band, baked into that band, and is baked into almost every great, you know, from Little Richard through to Sly and the Family Stones or whatever.
Yeah.
There's that tension between God and the dollar.
Yes.
And the church, but you can read in that piece that all of the tensions between her sort of political and social, you know, the ambitions she had to change things. I think it's the mechanics of the business, and having been in the business, you could see, and I still manage artists myself now, but you can really see how that might test a sensitive soul, you know.
Hasn't one of them just been jailed?
Yes, it's to do with financial advice and kind of influence over.
Better be careful what you say.
I've got a bit of landing myself in Rock's Back Pages podcast,
the litigation episode.
was in court three times.
But I mean, what a great record that is, though. I mean, Killing Me Softly.
It's extraordinary.
Just wonderful stuff. Killing Me Softly. So do you think it was that it was a frustration then at not being able to do what they wanted to do from a political, you know, not change the industry in the way that they thought they might be able to change the industry that led to...
I think you're spot on. I think when you get a collective like that, any band is a collective, and when there's a spiritual basis to what you do, there's a belief. All bands are just blind faith. That's what they are. There are a bunch of people that go, yeah, it can be us. You know, when you look at the common factors between all successful artists, the ones that kind of start out, they all start out with this naive energy, if you like. Sure. That, I mean, I was a dreadfully naive person in those early days. But you need that naivety in order to get...
You wouldn't do it otherwise, would
you? Yeah. Yeah.
All bands have blind faith except blind faith.
Except blind faith.
Cynical.
But that comes...
I also think they smoke far too much weed. I can't help... She strikes me as someone who's got sort of weed smoker psychosis.
Again, that's she's notoriously litigious, I believe.
Except it's legal now. I mean, I've just been in New York for a week, and you can't walk down any New York street now without getting major contact high. It's quite alarming. I mean, it's pretty much the same here, but really intense there.
Yeah. Anyway, moving
on. Anyway, just one thing we just want to throw in, another footnote or tangent we want to throw in. I wasn't here for the last very entertaining episode with the excellent, the lovely Sylvia Patterson. Right at the end of that, Mark mentions who our next guest is going to be, which is you. And she goes, what did she say? She's like, oh, Jasper, I've got a story about gay dad. It didn't go well or something like that. So I had to ask you about that. She interviewed you for...
She interviews for The Face, actually. For The Face, So it was a piece for The Face. Actually, the piece was pretty good, and it caught the sort of chaotic streaming 24-hour emergency funfair that was Gay Dad at that point. I mean, we were in the eye of the... Actually, we weren't in the eye of the storm, because that's calm. We were kind of spinning round the edges, because when it hit, and this what links this thing. Artists that survive and thrive and do really well, generally the tsunami hits them and they cope and they come through the other side, and it makes them stronger, better. You know, they can carry on.
Yeah.
But it does take out a lot of people. And that constant touring that the Fugees were doing, for example, that wearing down.
Yeah.
And they caught us, or Sylvia caught us. I don't think any of us had slept for weeks.
Right.
Because when it hits, you can feel it coming like a tsunami.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And
there's no time to sleep.
Yeah. Mm. I was in a pub once. We did Top of the Pops. And I was in a pub in Chiswick with the band. And I went up to get some drinks, went up to buy some drinks for the band. And this is when I realised things had changed, because on the TV monitor suspended above the bar, there's a big old cathode ray thing. And I'm standing at the bar, bearing in mind I'm probably about as far away from this person as you are, that he turns to his mate and goes, and I'd just come on. You recorded it on a Wednesday, it played out on a Thursday. And it just come on, and I felt a momentary thing of pride. I thought, oh, that's at me. There was no sound on, so you couldn't hear anything. It was just the image coming down. And the guy turned to the mate next to him, look at that fucking cunt. And pointed at the TV. And I did, I thought, oh, this is what fame is. You've got to deal with this. You've got to sit next to people. And what's the protocol here? Do I go, here I am? See that C-U-N-T up there? That's me. But that...
So what did you do?
Recapsized it. I got my pints and I shrank back to the table.
Yes, that's the right thing to do.
Of course.
Kind of, it's like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah. That is fantastic. Painful, what a great moment.
Yeah, and you know what? It's kind of amazing. There is a link, there is a theme to this. That the piece that I'm probably most proud of, even though it's not the best written piece from the Mojo years, was probably the Peter Green interview. Because he was the most extraordinary man I've ever met. And what an incredible
story. Tragic, bizarre story, really.
But he's somebody who, right when I interviewed him, just had this aura and innocence and hands that were like alabaster, not a wrinkle or a hair or anything on them, just sat on the pub tabletop. And I thought, wow. And then I went to the studio while he was recording, and he kept doing these incredible solos. No, it's not. There's no spirit in that. And he'd get them to erase it. And so what they had to do was, I can't believe it. Cozy Powell was producing.
Yeah.
And he said, over in the corner, there's a stack of Razzle magazines. Would you take some of them down after he's finished this take? And would you distract Peter? Would you put some of these in front of him? Because otherwise he's just going to keep erasing all these genius solos. And that was my job. I just had to go pick up these kind
present
of horrible
him with copies of
and
Razzle.
and just distract him and say
had to be Razzle,
you know, low rent kind of cheap, terrible.
How bizarre,
and
very strange.
But he's somebody that had been through the whole money fame thing, and had somehow, I don't know how he'd done it, but he'd somehow maintained that aura of the absolute artist, so pure. I've never encountered it, but Lauren had it.
Right.
So when I met Lauren Hill for that Fugees piece, she had it. She was untouched. She was idealistic. She had a vision.
Also what made them both really vulnerable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, to hold on to innocence in this racket is not easy.
Yeah, and it is the meeting of it is, again, just before I signed, I got a lesson in this from Elton John, who's my last ever interview that I did, was with Elton.
And do have on RBP.
Oh, yes. You got it? Yes. I've seen that. Sound Your Funky Horn,
Sound
isn't
Your Funky Horn was the series, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes. The series.
It's the Mojo series.
But he knew about the band. So going back to, did anybody know about Gay Dad? Well, he knew about it. I don't know how he knew, but he was so plugged in. He knew everything.
Yeah.
He knew all the current releases, everything. He was probably the most switched on music person I've ever met. Knew everything.
Still kind of like that. Strange, isn't it?
But he sat me down and gave me a long discussion about music plus business.
Right.
He said, that's the bit where you've got to keep yourself.
How
the music is that, and then the business is that.
Yeah.
Make sure you've got people that are as good as you are at creative stuff doing your business.
Yes.
So because you can't be poacher and gamekeeper, you know.
That's right. And he, of course, had got the whole mass management issues himself, John Reed and so on and so forth.
I mean, there speaks experience, right?
Yes, exactly. You mentioned the words poacher and gamekeeper, and you are, I would say, an almost unique example of someone who was a poacher turned gamekeeper, turned, well, one might use the term rockademic, because that's what we want to ask you about next, is just how you... I know you did some productions for XL Recordings. It wasn't like the end of Gay Dad in 2002 was the end of your involvement with music. You're still involved with music.
Yeah, very much
all
so.
Kind, yeah, yeah. You've got fingers in all kinds of pies. But when did... I don't know how you became involved with particularly with BIM or the world of academia.
I was... I've been working for Polydor, making a record for them. I'd made a record for Island Records for a great band, an all-girl punk band. They were brilliant, actually.
Called? Can you say
that?
They
were called Love Bites, I think.
Right.
It's on Island, anyway.
One of those should have been.
It was brilliant. They were really influenced by Led Zeppelin and Mark Bolan and all these great bands. They were all 16, so they had a chaperone in the studio who sat there doing with headphones on while they were playing, knitting. And I'm not kidding. And she'd look at her phone. She'd look up at the... I recorded it at Rack down in...
Right, London.
And she'd look up at the gallery. And what that meant was, you've got to stop in 30 seconds because otherwise you go over the time limit that the girls are allowed
to
play.
They need to go home and do their homework.
They need to go home and do their homework.
Oh, right.
So she sat in the studio... But they kept, we really love Led Zeppelin. We really, the vocalist was going, oh, I'm really influenced by, Zeppelin and Bolan and this. And we were in Rack. It's absolutely true. They were playing on an early PlayStation and Robert Plant walks in the room.
Oh, my God.
Standing behind me. I'm having a long conversation with Robert Plant about, we're talking about folk music, actually. Right, we're talking about, and the Folk Society, he's part of. And he left the room and went about his... But he was recording a record next door in one of the big rooms. And the girls just went, who's that bloke? Is he the studio owner? The guy hosts the studio. I said, actually, no. Really, no. That's that man that you keep saying. Right. And from that band that you love.
So he was frozen in time in their memories.
For them, it was like he was wearing flares and kind of long hair. And,
Naked.
And that's what I thought. That's what I love about this business. It's kind of
that
like
is
that.
Fantastic. What a great. But did they then rush in and demand to talk
carried
to
on
him,
playing the game, kind of have a cup of tea. And it was. But that, I made albums for Island and Polydor, XL Recording. So I was based out in. Austin, Texas for a while. I found all these really great bands. A band called Young Heart Attack, who I got signed from there to here. They're an amazing band.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of commercial songwriting. So I co-wrote with Sia, so some of Sia's stuff. Mm. Loads of artists and cuts. And that's how I spent my time.
Yeah.
And EMI Publishing, who are my publishers, somebody there said, oh, well, he used to be a journalist. He's reasonably... knows a few things about music and recommended me to the guy that started BIM. And I came in and I did a couple of sessions on songwriting and 15, 16 years later, I'm course leading and I'm a research supervisor and I do help students on a media course, music media course, and
yeah.
So and it just grows. It just it's like all these things grows organically.
But it's obviously it intersects with what we do because BIM subscribes to RVP and so forth. And
a number of our writers, Neil Kulkarni, Simon Price.
Yeah. Well, I work with people like Jerry Thackeray. Jerry and John McCready and all those people. I have to say, I'm not just saying this because I've been invited on. It's a flipping fantastic resource.
Yeah.
Because what you're asking them to do is understand how these narratives have been formed. And what's interesting about the pieces that you asked me to read, the Brian Jones one that probably we're going to come on to in a minute, but the obituary, the Graham Marcus obituary, and the piece by, was it Dawn?
Dawn James.
That Dawn James piece is unbelievable.
Well, she's a fantastic. I mean, she's
great,
terrific.
Great run.
I mean,
1966.
I know.
Summer 66.
She
knew something was wrong. Sorry, but she knew something was up.
But it's written.
But she, I mean, that's the thing is she put this stuff in a pop paper. You know, well, she did this interview with Eric Clapton just after he'd left John Mayall. And, or maybe it's just after he'd left the Yardbirds. Can't remember. Anyway, she spots his depression and she writes.
She names it
in this piece. And this is for Rave, for a teen girls magazine. Yeah. Such good writing.
But isn't that, I mean, I read it and I was staggered at the tone of a piece.
Yeah.
Not only the perspective of the writer and the boldness in the writing, but for the period.
I
can't think of anybody that was writing like that then.
I mean, for me, one of the great joys of this job is the reclamation of the great women pop writers of the early and mid-60s. Yeah. You know, this idea that music journalism started in 1966, which is kind of quite pervasive. I mean, you could say rock criticism, inverted commas, did.
Yeah.
But there was great pop writing before that. I'm Maureen Cleave, who's Evening Standard, one of my favourite, writers. Dawn James is...
Yeah, I was really... I mean, it was the reason I picked it, because there's a few early Brian Jones pieces, as opposed to just early Rolling Stones pieces. But they're often by male writers who just sort of talk about Brian driving around London in his Bentley.
Yes.
You know? And I don't think a male writer would have written that piece at Dawn.
I agree.
No. She absolutely... You're so right. Yeah. She names it, and she calls it, and she makes it the... It's the opening paragraph of that piece. I'm just like, oh my God.
Men were too respectful of their fellow males, really.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like it's all the other way. And let's talk about Brian Jones, because a lot of what we've talked about sort of applies to Brian. You were talking about narratives and myths, and obviously Nick Broomfield has just made this documentary about Brian. The Stones and Brian Jones.
Yeah.
I get confused because there's another one.
Yeah.
But we've all watched at least some of it over the last few days. I think you've seen it.
Yeah.
And and I finished watching it this morning. And, you know, talk about a sort of a narrative and really a very sad and quite disturbing story, actually. I just thought, you know, let's just talk a little bit about Brian Jones. What did you think of Nick's film?
I'm a big fan of Nick Broomfield's work in general. I was slightly wrong-footed by it because, again, after reading Carol's piece, you know, the 2005 Uncut piece, you realise that's a much more linear narrative and has a lot more detail. And so much of that story was left out of the documentary.
Yeah.
Important things in my view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the narrative there is a strong narrative. It's about class. It's about, you know, reactionary beliefs around what Britishness should be, about what a good career is.
Yeah, yeah.
As Nick points out, you know, the two epochs kind of clash. Mm-hmm. There was a casualty in the middle, and those 27 Club people tended to be, you know, the pioneers get all the arrows, don't they? And that's really, that was well articulated in there. But I think some people were let off the hook rather too lightly, if you ask me. And I think
M. Jagger and Kay Richards particularly, perhaps.
Yeah.
But others as well.
I do. I think there was very little discussion of Andrew Lloyd Oldham's role, and I know that he was instrumental in fostering the Nanka Felge Jagger Richards thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know why it might have happened, because they were on that roller coaster. It was money and it was success. And Brian's skills and talents were a lot more in the, you know, it was more about the sort of, I hate to use the word authenticity, but I think the aesthetic of the blues. He was much more involved in that, I think, than the others. And I think that was missed, really, because I didn't really get a sense of how or why Brian was as powerful or potent creative force as he actually was.
I think that's true, but then it does something that no other documentary I've seen about the Stones has ever done, which is really concentrated upon him as a person,
mm-hmm.
and particularly his relationships with women, which were extraordinary. And I mean, we were speculating how many children he'd had. And
well, I think at least five illegitimate women.
I think it's Boris
women.
Levels, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but exactly.
Really.
That's exactly well, what
we
said.
Were saying. He was the rock and roll Boris Johnson, yeah. except not completely shameless and sociopathic. Well, he may have had sociopathic tendencies. I mean, he's very, very strange guy to be in that band. So. Did not fit in that band.
I think you're right.
You pointed out that it didn't cover his death at all in the way
just
that...
skimmed
it,
right over there.
Which, again, I thought was actually not a bad idea, because then it becomes a different documentary altogether.
Well the previous one goes into really lurid, sensationalist detail about the death.
Yeah, and then, again, the mythos around the death, you know, the idea that it was somehow, you know, people sent down and that, you know, it was a roadie that did it and this, that and the other. Those things have been pervasive for 30 years. So, 40 yeah. years. Yeah. It's a kind of slight trope of...
Yeah,
of
it's inevitable,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. And I think it did well to sidestep some of that. I think the focus on his father, I think, was particularly interesting because I think, and particularly that letter that came out was very...
I'm not ashamed to say that was the last thing I saw this morning, and I started welling up because it was so tender
and it's so small.
Someone on Facebook posted a scan of a letter his father sent, I think, to the Times. It may have been the Times. I'm not sure. After his death, about his dear boy, and thanking all the well wishes and so on, the fans and all that for the, you know, but. There was love in this letter. These are buttoned-up people who could barely use the term, you know.
Yes.
And his letter to his father and this letter from his father were just a really interesting, companion pieces. Mm. That, you know, however impossible their relationship was in many respects, there was love there.
Yeah, but, you know, it's that, I mean, that's the story, and Nick does say that is the story. The story is the transition point between two cultures, two eras and epochs, really, sort of austerity Britain, 50s austerity Britain, and that obsession with, you know, that the middle classes have with sort of aspirant culture and education and respectability, all of that is built into the documentary.
Yeah.
And it's probably, for me, the single most important strand in the documentary because, you know, the relationship with women is a byproduct of a failing...
Yeah, but
it's a small man syndrome he had, I think. And I think there was a bullying culture, you know, he was seen as somebody that really knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
And then when you get Jagger suddenly realising, okay, I've got this.
Yeah.
And I'm a business person and we're a band and we're making money and the songs I'm writing with Keith seem to be doing rather well, this person becomes somebody that you might just go, well, you know what?
It's quite a playground thing going on, isn't it? You know, it's like little Brian in the playground and Mick and Keith are no longer playing with
there's that moment when Brian's being interviewed by some American TV guy and he says, you write the songs, and Brian says, no, I don't actually, that's Mick and Keith. And
so awkward, isn't it?
It's extraordinary.
Jagger's head turns slightly to see what Brian's going to say.
Yeah, I noted that.
Is he going to be honest or is he going to lie and say, yeah, we all write the songs together? It was such an interesting moment.
It really was.
I mean, the other thing was interesting to me was that Zuzu, who's interviewed in there, and she really makes the point that he hated Satisfaction. He hated these pop songs. Mm. You know, he was very, very confined in his blues purism. But he would tell people, I can't stand these songs they're writing. Yeah. They're just nothing to do with what we were supposed to be about.
Interestingly, parallel with Eric Clapton leaving the Yardbirds for precisely that reason.
Yeah.
You know, going back to that Dawn James Clapton interview. You know, you can't be a purist if you want to get huge, you know.
Although, of course, Little Red Rooster, that with Bill Wyman's really interesting. Actually, Bill Wyman's really interesting in the documentary.
And he doesn't hold back,
to
and
do
he's great.
With it.
Yeah.
Paul Trinker, of course, was a co-producer of it as
I wish Paul had actually been. What did they phone him up?
Well, there's sort of weird because
Paul is in London. What are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is because obviously a lot of it was made during the pandemic.
Yeah.
So a lot of the interviews are done on the phone or on Zoom.
There's a lot of Zoom.
Right, I do understand.
Which is interesting.
But just to pick up on that point, there's a track, it's one of the last tracks from the London years, and it is incredible because it shows you how Brian, had he been encouraged a bit, would have delivered the musical esoterica that they needed. Yeah. I know he did with the kind of sitars and all that kind of obvious stuff. Mm. But there's a solo on it. Is it called "Cause I Love You"? Or
I don't
is that
know.
Track? It's one of the last things he ever did.
Right.
But it's the most incredible slide solo. It's just incendiary. It's like lightning.
Mm-hmm.
And you realise that actually he probably was somebody that was channeling the blues in a really amazing way, and would have, I think, would have gone on to be a really amazing, not a virtuoso guitarist, but a soulful guitarist right. in that space.
Well,
I don't think he was given that
also undervalued is, you know, the way he decorated a lot of those pop hits, a lot of the pre-Beggars stuff,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
It's not my favourite Stones. My favourite Stones really does start with Beggars and Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Yeah.
But when you listen to things like Paint It Black, you know, Mother's Little Helper, Ruby Tuesday, so much of the sort of slightly baroque decoration is going on. I'm actually, you listen to it kind of with fresh ears after seeing the film. And you realise that he was just doing some really imaginative stuff.
It is interesting how he effectively ceased to be a member of the band long before he left the band. I mean, we've all seen that really terrible I love Jean-Luc Godard, but One Plus One is a ghastly film.
Yeah.
but it is interesting because it's the making of Beggars, isn't it? And he's still in the band.
Yes.
And he's just not there. If he's in the studio, he's just sat in the corner. You know, he's not participating.
I have a theory about all of this, and it links Syd Barrett
to
this. My theories about Syd are that there were things that went on with his perception of self and self-esteem, and they weren't related to, am I in the band or am I not in the band? I think he was really obsessed with his hair. I think he was obsessed with the way he looked.
Yeah.
And when those things started to sort of go a bit wrong for him, I think he had a corkscrew perm to be a bit like Eric Clapton.
Yeah, right.
And I think some of his hair started breaking off and falling out. And I think the same for Brian. Brian, I think Nick really nailed the idea that physical decline in a 24-year-old looking as he did
is shocking.
And I think Brian himself would have seen that. And because it was all about the look, and he spent so much time primping. I remember in one of the Stones biographies I read years and years ago, there's just these amazing descriptions of Brian spending ages primping his hair.
Yeah, it was always immaculate even when
hair.
He was really fucked up.
Yeah.
And there's also the whole kind of narcissistic mirror reflection of Anita Pallenberg, the extraordinary and beautiful Anita.
She does
Pallenberg.
Not come across well, though.
she does. It's an awful story, and you realise how devastated he was when she went off with Keith. I mean, that's
he also treated her really awfully. So,
yeah, but there's so many pictures of them together.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like Brian
you
and
can't
Anita
really
together.
Blame
No, I agree.
You know
I agree.
Mean,
like, but I'm just saying that, you know, watching that film and actually the earlier documentary made me realise that he was utterly devastated and felt so betrayed.
Well, could you think of anything worse than, and again, it's really in that documentary, it's like, oh, well, this didn't happen over a period of months. This happened over a weekend in a hotel
She
popped out of one room and went into
Volker
the other one.
Schlondorf basically sort of saw Anita walking out of Brian's room and in the morning went into Keith's room and she was in Keith's bed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's graphic.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of that in her. You get the sense that she was, in her own way, disturbed enough to find the chaos and destruction of other people's worlds
sexy
and fun. Like, you know what?
Yeah.
This is just me. I'm so beautiful.
Yeah.
I just walk through here and people fall over and stuff happens and the gods fucking destroy
me. But she
was
intellectual too. And I mean, I would make the case that she was almost like the demonic force behind the new Rolling Stones that emerged out of that chaos.
Well,
you know, without Anita, you could say no Beggars, no Gimme Shelter, no
Sympathy of the Devil. I completely agree. Yeah. And it was the introduction to that sort of European art cognoscenti, you know, and the high culture. And you know, people in that bracket, you know, even now, they do hedonism really well.
Yes.
Yeah, you know,
because they can afford it, basically, hedonism, not sort of the opposite
hedonism of Brian Jones.
And it comes from that Byronic Shelleyan thing.
That's where I went wrong. I never had the cash to have the
Brian Shelley.
My alter ego.
I could have been a contender.
Thank you.
We're now going to talk about somebody completely different.
Yes, I'm so enjoying this, by the way. You guys are so fun. It's so fun.
Well, I knew you'd be one.
I came all the way from Great Portland Street. That's a reference, right?
Yes, you know, yes.
We are going to talk about almost like a sort of polar opposite to Brian Jones, which is Paul Simon, who releases a new album this week called Seven Psalms. I know you'll be rushing out to buy that, Mark. Interesting guy, Paul Simon.
This very interesting interview. Tony Sherman, August 93. It's part of a very long interview, but three quarters of the interviews are rather poor quality phone, though. This is the only raised face-to-face in Paul's office in the Brill Building. And
so cool. So that's a flex, isn't it? Right there.
And that, in a sense, triggers the whole early part of the interview, which is about the early days of him working at 1050 Broadway, which is the other of those buildings, and a Brill Building. As a songwriter, as a demo guitar player playing electric guitar. He talks later in the interview about actually the decision to stop using an electric guitar and to become an acoustic guitar player. And all the small labels and the gangsters, the Morris Leavers of this world and so on and so forth. And we'll listen to the first clip because he talks about their roots in doo-wop, and his point being that the British didn't get doo-wop. And that's very much where he comes from.
I keep referring back to this element of music that I started with. But for most of the world, certainly the English kids, they never heard it. Yeah, well, this wasn't exported. You know, they heard Frankie Lyman, and that was it. So they don't have any, they didn't have any experience with doo-wop groups singing sideways and on corners. So the only thing, that people know of that is like those couple of those television shows in Greece, and that, which was not what it was.
Yeah, but I mean, it's such a thrill. Like, I'm the obvious child that, you know, you, that falsetto thing is just goes boom. That's you know, when you go, that's right. Street corner.
That's from Desiree.
Yeah. I didn't know that, you know.
Desiree. That's the lick that they sang in Desiree. Desiree.
Which I just think is really interesting. And he's right that doo-wop really had virtually no penetration in this country at all.
And that whole New York street corner thing is so central to
absolutely central.
What Paul Simon is about.
And what Simon and Garfunkel were about, very much. He then actually talks about, this is a very back and forth interview, but he talks about getting into the Greenwich Village folk scene, seeing Dylan seeing him and so on and so forth, selling his electric guitar. Then he talks about, quite extensively, about going to England, why he went to England. First of all, he was actually going to go to France. He was going on having a holiday, and then he went to France.
Like him in a whole other career.
He was busking in Paris, comes over to England, stays for quite some time.
He's on Cable Street.
That's right.
As in the Battle of Cable
Street. I think he stayed the same.
That was where my first... I lived on Cable Street.
But I believe it may be the same house that Lon Goddard stayed in. Oh. It was this extraordinary sort of folk hangout. This woman ran this house, and a lot of people there. And very, I know Lon Goddard stayed in the place near Cable Street.
Lon is coming over.
I know.
We can ask him.
Very much looking forward to that. So he talks about that and really getting into the English folk scene. So Tony Sherman saying, but you were a folk singer. And he says, no, I wasn't. I was a doo-wop guy. I was a pop songwriter. And it was English folk, not American folk, it was English folk which really got to him, hence Parsley Sage, Sure. in Time, and so on and so forth. And then he also, back and forth, talks about recording demos with Carole King and stuff like that.
Yeah, lots of demos with Carole.
How he and Art loved and copied the Everly Brothers substantially in many, many ways. He talks at one point about the evolution of his songwriting through Simon Garfunkel into his solo stuff, which is very interesting. And we'll listen to the last clip, which is his admiration for Art Garfunkel's voice and the antagonism between them. I think it's has been overplayed or been played up. And this is really interesting. Him just talking.
Really had a and in pop music at the time, there weren't that many voices that were really great. I think the guy who sang with the Mamas and Papas, the singer, was ahead of
Danny.
Was Danny.
Sang Real Monday Mondays.
Pretty.
But he, but was he, but you know, the, he was not, I mean, you can see in the solo albums, I mean, you know, he was not like a musical quester.
Right. But, you know, it's, I think people, because his post Simon Garfunkel career is so disappointing on so many levels, I think people like, they undervalue what he was. In the period, considering what that whole era was in terms of singers, he could stand up with any of those singers, and I'd be really afraid. He'd stand up in a concert hall and sing, you know, just knock people out.
Like a bridge over troubled water, I will.
He says that he loved being in a group, and that actually, if you look at his solo career is him being surrounded by other voices, and it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
You know, there's gospel choirs, there's all kinds of stuff going on. You know, and he said he liked that, and that's what he liked about being in Simon and Garfunkel was, you know, Art's voice and all that. It's an interesting interview.
You said you've added a review of Hearts and Bones this week.
That was a couple of weeks ago.
Cliff mentioned before we started recording that you've been listening to that.
Yes,
so how does that stand up for you? He really, really liked it.
I mean... He comes with many caveats, doesn't he, Paul Simon?
Yes, he does.
as a human and as a musician. Yeah. It's really interesting that you focused on Garfunkel, because I'm a big believer in the idea that the union between certain characters, you know, when you, I mean, people always talk about this, you know, the Beatles, the trope of, like, you know, Ringo. Ringo is an incredible drummer, by the way, but if you take that out, you haven't got that magic.
Right.
And bands that have magic, even if somebody is annoying as a drummer or a bassist or whatever it is, you know, and there's tension in the band, it is that magic.
Yeah.
And I think the magic that he had with Garfunkel, just, I'm not going to call it chemistry because it's the wrong word, but there's a balancing out there. And I've always, I mean, so Art Garfunkel's solo records are equally great, and I've come some to love. Yeah, I've come to love sense. Some of his work.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean,
great.
The guy's right for a compilation, right? Somebody should do a really good reissue of compilation. Yeah. But you hear it in Hearts and Bones.
Right.
There are some great tracks, but it marks the end of his, if you like, that period of mourning for the Garfunkel years. I feel that it's some beautiful tracks on that record. Some really, really great tracks. Even though I know it wasn't commercially successful,
right.
I think Mo Austin really liked it. As a record, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, he introduced me to a lot of stuff that I subsequently love. I mean, the band staff, you know, Richard T and Steve Gadmiller.
Yeah.
My introduction was basically those first two Paul Simon records, and also Muscle Shoals Rhythm Section.
Yeah.
A lot of that stuff. His choice in musicians was immaculate.
On that record, for example, it's bizarre. But a little credit at the bottom goes to Philip Glass for orchestration.
Which album?
Hearts and Bones.
Hearts and Bones,
yeah.
Right.
It's like ridiculous.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
it's like ludicrous.
Yeah, yeah.
All of those people, Steve Gadd's on there, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a couple of others who are really...
Well, Steve Gadd's,
oh, Al Demiola.
Steve Gadd's incredible playing on 50 Ways to Leave Your Love.
Yes.
I mean, one of the great Steve Gadd choices.
Yeah. And what a great record.
And
well,
I mean, that is probably my favourite solo album. By Simon. It is so just luscious.
Yeah.
It's as luscious as Steely Dan.
You know,
it's gorgeous.
It sounds like in the 50 Ways to Leave Your Love. It's just, you know, with Richard T's Fender Rhodes piano all over it. It's just, you know.
50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Or hop on the bus, Gus.
Ah, one could go on.
And I mean, the Graceland album, all of the musicians on that are...
But we saw a shocking...
I loved the Graceland album when it came out.
Politics really gets in the way with
it. It does slightly get in the way.
You know, I really... I thought what he did was a shocking breach of...
I remember at the time there were many of them. It was, you know, what's that place, City Sun City. Yeah, that whole thing. Really, really important.
Yeah.
But when I think about Peter Gabriel, I think about him. I think about what people like Kate Bush were doing. It was the opening up, and I see almost like what came after this Hearts and Bones album, which was Graceland. That spelt the emergence of a new kind of artist.
The way he did it was like, this is more about my art and fuck the politics. Well, Kate Bush, Peter Gabriel were always acutely aware of the politics.
Yeah.
You know,
this is going to be controversial. I'm not sure that I think it was bad in the long run, because I think what it did was it exposed the world at a really critical time. You know, we've been through the sort of protracted adolescence of intellectual rock, 10 years of kind of, you know, progressive rock and everything else. And it did change things. It opened us up to a new palette of sounds.
I accept that, but we aren't going to agree on this. I think the way he made that record was wrong.
And yet, at the same time, was an introduction to that Mbakanga sound, which I absolutely loved. I fell in love with. It was an incredible compilation.
Yeah.
The Indestructible Sounds of Soweto.
Yes.
I think Jumbo.
Yeah. Well, there were two albums for me that cracked the egg. Really important. One was Malcolm McLaren's Duck Rock.
Duck Rock was just fantastic.
Which is crazy. Fantastic. It's a crazy record.
Yeah.
But
Those are two
bookmarks, aren't they? Two
double dots.
I think it is really important to acknowledge that it was a violation of something, and it was motivated by a certain selfish desire to make
a record. An arrogance that my art is more important than
what I was trying to say about it was just that the musician that he did work with, I mean, is it Ladysmith Black Mambazo that's on that record? I mean, astonishing musicians in their own right, and some of the music that comes out of it, if you can bracket the kind of political thing, which whether you can or can't is a difficult matter in many, with regards to many artists, not just Paul Simon, right? But if you can, I mean, some of those songs are just astonishing.
I think they, as musicians, were all very grateful for opening up that it had culturally.
The stuff is that a lot of the musicians who played in that really resented the fact that they brought stuff to the individual songs, which deserve songwriting credit.
I do know that. Yes, I do agree with that. As an academic framework, cultural appropriation is something we're really hot on.
And I try rock and roll, you can't avoid.
I was talking to somebody about this. He's an amazing. He's somebody I work with. He's a conservatoire trained. You know, comes from a sort of evangelical family in the States, and he was just saying within sort of black churches in America, the sin is not, it's where all this kind of crossroads stuff comes from. He said the sin is not the making of the music, it's taking the music and putting new clothes on it and being paid for it.
Right.
Because they've, you know, the music is seen as community music. So when you're talking about cultural appropriation, you're actually saying this is community music. And if you're not rewarding the community in some way, if you're appropriating not just the music, but the income streams.
It's rewards,
it's rewards. What it reaps. Exactly.
And rewriting the words, so it's not about God, but about fucking, basically. You know, it sort of has something to do with it.
Is what I thought but didn't say.
We don't do thinking but not saying on this podcast, I'm afraid.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket, with nothing to lose.
We're sort of running out of time. We're recording this on Wednesday, the 17th of May, and we heard at the beginning of the week that we had lost one of our most treasured contributors, Pete Silverton, who was a legend at Sounds and one of the really important early punk writers.
Yeah.
And we're really sad about this. He was also one of the first, one of the batch of first writers who came on board at
back in 1999 or whenever it was.
Yeah, this hits us quite hard. Yeah. So we're featuring him in the Long Goodbye section. Two of his pieces, one of the very first pieces he wrote for Sound, and he talks about this in an interview that I found online from 2010. The second piece he wrote for Sounds was Jeff Barton, the Sounds, sent him up to Manchester to write about the Anarchy Tour. And we've had that on RBP for some time. The second piece is his recalling meeting Sid Vicious for the first time, long before John, whatever his name was, became Sid Vicious.
John Beverly.
It's a fascinating little memoir piece that Pete wrote for The Observer years later. But there's great stuff. I mean, there's so much great punk writing.
And he's such a stylish writer, very funny.
Really great writer.
Really good.
Really great writer.
But he also made the decision to get out right at the right time, moved into editorial stuff and so on and so forth.
He had a very, very illustrious career on Fleet Street. Yes. He was involved with The Guardian. He was involved with, like, launching The Guide.
Yes.
He was involved, he was at The Mail on Sunday. He was involved with Night and Day magazine.
Yeah.
You know, he had been ill for a couple of years.
That's
And so it's not been the best.
But it's tremendously
the best
sad.
Experience. Yeah. So we're really sorry to lose Pete. You know, do check out his pieces on the site. And at this point, we'll talk about some of the pieces you've added to the library.
Yeah, the last 2 weeks, Maureen and Cleave interviewing Rick Gunnell, the legendary approach of the Flamingo.
He's somewhat notorious.
Notorious. We run it hard but well. You get all sorts there. Gangsters, little kids out for the evening. They all mix quite happily. I mean, he was a gangster, wasn't he?
I think let's not mince words. The Gunnell brothers.
1974, Judith Sims interviewing Average White Band's Alan Gorry. And first of all, we're talking about cultural appropriation. He says, they were a white funk band, you know, which is one of the
first.
They
put it in the name, after all.
And he says, black music is all we ever liked. It's a really tough country, Scotland, with slums, real ghettos, and an amazing self-mocking sense of humour. Same as black people. Right, Alan. He also, this is not long after Robbie McIntosh, the drummer, died, and he talks a bit about this, that the bit about Cher saving my life was greatly exaggerated. Actually, I just went outside and hit the bushes and stayed there a long time throwing up. So there we go. This week, Danielle Dax to Mick Sinclair Sounds in 1983. She says, I think it'd be a healthy thing for the music industry if John Peel died next week.
It's
depressing that one person can have so much control over a vast area of music which the public doesn't otherwise have access to. You'd better to have someone younger and more in touch doing John Peel's job. He's been doing it so long, he's become too cynical and image conscious. He's got a weird kind of inverted snobbery. Now, I think that's a pretty interesting thing to say, and I think there's some truth in it as well.
I think there is a kernel of truth in it.
Without necessarily having to wish death upon
him. No, I think he's going a little bit too far there. Maybe she just meant that in terms of, well, then someone younger could come in. But the
kernel of truth that he became the gatekeeper for a whole
series. It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because that, the Peel trope.
Yeah.
Has become one that pervades the culture. It's almost like we've reinvented Peel.
Yeah.
Well, he's a sainted figure.
A sainted, holy Peel.
You criticise his legacy at your peril in a way. It's quite interesting to hear someone
talking
about that.
Which may explain why her career went down.
He's never played on BBC Radio again.
And then secondly, this is coming from 1989, given the current debate, particularly in America happening here, this is Mike G of the Jungle Brothers, to Jeff Larez and Blues and Soul, saying, everyone knows slavery existed, and the struggle for black people in this country. But in school, it's just covered over, and black people aren't even taught their own histories. As it's an important part of American history, it's something that should be given a lot of attention in schools, but instead, the only way you can really study about it is on college courses in higher education. This is spot on, you know? And I find the idea of Black History Week really nauseating, because black history should be every week, because it's our history. I mean, talking about British history...
Sure.
That black history is our history.
I think there. I've read a lot about this, and some of my research as an academic is in this area.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we do need to remember is that the bit that I mean, I'm sitting around this table with three other white.
You noticed?
I take every box. So I'm
well, I like to
white,
point out that I'm Sephardic Jewish on one part of my family, so
almost black.
Okay, right. But the issue is, and again, as somebody, I represent sort of catalogues and artists, Delia Derbyshire. Yeah. The story, as I think you said at the beginning of this, is often controlled by people like us.
Yeah.
It's the story we want to write. Mm. And we feel we're doing a really good job when we say, you've been chosen. we're going to elevate your story.
Yeah.
The idea of Black History Month is to put it in the calendar.
Agreed.
To make students and people more widely aware of this. And you're coming from a very low baseline.
Yeah, no, look, I think I'm sad that it has to exist, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, this is slightly controversial because I'd say it's kind of none of our business.
Because it's...
You know, there's always this thing is that we're giving voice to people. You're not giving them a voice. They've got a voice already. It's just no one's listening to it. So the point really is that through things like academic study, through what you people are doing here and the things you promote here, the articles you put out to the world, these podcasting discussions that we have, is that you integrate that story into, and it takes a long time, that becomes a narrative that is recontextualized, retold.
Sure.
And it has to be retold at least one generation ahead so that the people receiving that new narrative are not aware that it's been a corrected narrative, that it's something that we've gone, okay, well, we need to promote these people. Because as soon as you you get that distance from it, it just becomes the story.
I mean, in a sense, reception studies is sort of the technical thing, of the expression for looking at contemporaneous sources.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a way, that's what
we do, and what I love about Mojo, for example, you keep going, well, how does Mojo keep going? how does it keep writing about the same things? Well, as Paul Simon said, every generation throws a hero up the pop charts, you know?
Yeah.
The point with this is that every generation recontextualizes the meaning of the Beatles.
Yeah.
The Beatles mean something different to my daughter, who's 22, than they do to me, than they did to my mother, and so on. So this constant reframing and revisioning of history through the things that we write, we say, the stories we tell. Because everything that we've talked about today is just somebody's story.
Yeah.
It's just the story of Sylvia Patterson, who happened to be on a train with me on that particular day.
With a broken tape recorder.
I smashed her tape recorder. The truth finally pops out. Yeah. I smashed her Sony tape recorder. But the point is, that's one perspective, and what is a highly plural landscape where you and we and journalists have to be opinionated, have to tell a story, but also have to be highly reflexive. And that means constantly reimagining what stories we're telling and why we're telling them and to who we're telling them.
And equally, it's interesting going back to the original sources, the original storytellers, and the eye-wateringly awful language they frequently use, the naked sexism of most of the male journalists, and, you know, and that's revealing and that's interesting.
It's also part of the narrative of the period. That has to be embodied in the narrative. Yeah. It is the narrative.
Yeah. You can't
rewrite that narrative, but you can question it and you can say, hey, that's what it was like.
And you
like
can put
then.
It into a context and you can...
Your job, or our job as journalists now, is to take this amazing history and to recontextualize it and make it relevant for a whole new group of people for whom history begins 3 years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought that Mike G's thing, Jungle Brothers, is interesting, particularly in the light of what, let's say, in Florida is happening, which is basically we will not allow any sort of this black history of any sort of description. So, and this is 1989, and the same battle.
Yeah.
In fact, it's more difficult battle being fought now than it was even in 1989.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's really overtly fascist.
I do think you've got to listen to the people whose story it is.
Of course.
Yeah. Because they will tell you how they want it to be told.
Yeah. Yes.
And absolutely. It's our job to kind of find ways, if we have any of that territory, like we're in a position to put things in magazines if we're editors, it involves sacrifice of territory.
Yeah.
It says, this is not the narrative anymore. You're going to tell me what the narrative is.
Yeah.
And I am going to honour that by... You know, which is why I love some of these. I mean, put it this way, in the Johnny Cigarettes interview with me, I know I didn't say that, and 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 I didn't say that. In other words, the narrative has been wrestled from me. And I think some of what we're able to do now, particularly through social media, is that narrative now comes out as it's meant to be told.
One of the values of putting audio interviews on Rock's Back Pages is you get the whole interview from which maybe a 1,500-word piece is written. And it's startling how sometimes the two things don't seem to sort of...
Yeah. I suppose it's possible Johnny Cigarettes might have the tape of that interview, so we could actually...
That would be, yeah, quite interesting. It would be of interest to about 10 people, Barney.
Yes, but those 10 people will be
really... What I think is amazing is journalists still, and it's the bit that I miss now, mm-hmm. is I love some of the things that you've asked me to read and some of the things on Rock's Back Pages. I love every now and again, yeah. I'll just for fun, yeah. I'll go and read... Charles Murray. But the important thing is that they are people telling a story. They're like magicians. Yeah. And I want to hear the magicians telling the story again.
I love this thing about, you know, I didn't say that. I was once interviewed for Blues and Soul, and the guy didn't use a tape recorder. He did shorthand. So he'd ask a question and sort of stare into the distance while yeah. writing. And when the interview came out, I don't think any of us had a single word that...
I mean, that's how I used to operate. I remember doing the Oasis interview, and most of it was ethnographic. I just hung around with him for a week and just watched and made my little field notes and wrote them up. Back into your past, brother. My forefather was a king. He wore fat gold chains and fat ruby rings. Nobody believes this to be true. Maybe it's because my eyes ain't blue. You ain't gonna find it in your history book. Come here, young blood, and take a look. You dig down deep inside.
I've got just a couple of things I wanted to mention because they pertain to new albums that are coming out this week. Simply Red have a new album out, and you, as it happens, had added this
Frantic Elevators.
Frantic Elevators, live.
Our very first Frantic Elevators piece.
Yeah. Wow. So, April 1982, Melody Maker, Penny Kiley. It's a review of a gig at Adams Club in Liverpool. And among other things, she just says, their vocals are always the strong point, whether impressively reminiscent of the rock and roll John Lennon or in the flatter tones employed in The Fool. And then she says at the end, the Frantic Elevators music is now tending to be filtered through a love of the blues. There's no sense of revivalists here, though. The result is a dateless beat music with an identity of its own and many sides. The recording should be well worth hearing. Yeah. So I think there was a single, but then...
Then after that, Holding Back Years was a Frantic Elevators single, the first version of it, before Simply Red redid it and had the hit.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that Dave Matthews has a new album out, or the Dave Matthews Band. And I just wanted to sort of mention, you may have forgotten this, that in the very early days of LBP, we actually sort of did some interviews with a few people, like Richard Hell.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
You took photographs. And we managed to get this interview with Dave Matthews, because even though he was like practically the biggest star in America at that point, he meant nothing here.
Yeah.
So we were able to have this interview with him. It was at the Grouch, upstairs at the Grouch Show Club.
I have no memory of this.
Well, I'll just... So, as what I wrote as the intro to what was a Q&A. Interviewed in Soho's painfully hip Groucho Club, a rather different establishment to Miller's, the cafe in Charlottesville, Virginia, where Dave played his first gigs a decade ago. Matthews is humble and mumbling, a big Tom Hanks bear of an icon. He talked about working with Alanis Morissette mentor Glenn Ballard. He talked about his Quakerist view of the war on terrorism. And he talked about the luxury of walking down a London street without being accosted. So you've completely forgotten it.
I have absolutely erased Dave Matthews from that.
We're featuring that interview in the long read section on the homepage. So fantastic. Over to you, Jasper.
Thank you very much. Yeah, just two things I want to mention that both kind of tie in a little bit to the sorts of things we're saying. First of which is a review, a fairly long review by Mark Anthony Neal in Pop Matters of Erykah Badu's Worldwide Underground, which is in 2003. And it's a review, but it's also kind of a deconstruction of what neo soul was, and concludes on this note, which is fascinating and goes into the academic side of things. In her brilliant essay, It's Not Right But It's Okay, Black Women's R&B and the House That Terry McMillan Built, from Souls, Daphne Brooks asserts that few critics have paid attention to the significance of narratives by black female R&B artists. Mm. She argues that black women's popular desire is thus depoliticized and disregarded for its reflections on domestic and socioeconomic politics and sexual fulfillment. But she adds that what critics have failed to realize, to fully interrogate, are the ways in which this subgenre also operates as an extension of hip-hop culture itself. Artists like Mary J. Blige, Lauryn Hill, Selena Johnson, Erykah Badu are the living embodiment of Brooks's observations. Though Blige has rightfully earned the reputation as the queen of hip-hop soul, perhaps Badu's Danger has upped the ante. This is a song for the hip-hop world in response to the hip-hop world. world, but giving a wide glimpse, an audience really, to the emotions and tensions that so much of hip-hop claim to represent. If the emotional and political depth of Danger, its song on this record, is the foundation of the next stage in R&B hip-hop, then it is a building I have no problem naming after Miss Badu. And I think it's really interesting because there is that sort of intersection of R&B and hip-hop and neo-soul and that whole space, and Mark Anthony Neal goes into all of that in this piece. So it's just a worthwhile read if you're interested in that sort of music, but then also its kind of political extensions. It's a great piece, a really great piece.
Actually, talking about, mention that Grant Park Chicago gig I went to where Lauryn Hill didn't come. Faith Evans was like second and third on the bill, and she was electrifyingly good in a way that her records never have been. You know, it was just her, three backing singers, a drummer, and a couple of keyboard players, and absolutely knocked me out. And you hear her records, and she's been reduced by men, male producers, and shoved into a certain sort of box. R&B box.
Yeah.
You know,
it happens. Happens across the board, and there's some great music there.
Cliff, when you hear something like that read out,
yes.
Do you, because you work in the kind of academic field, I assume, you know, it's not difficult for you to absorb that. Do you enjoy that? Do you think there's always a slight danger when you read someone like Daphne Brooks that it's a little sort of joyless and a bit too dry? Where do you stand on that?
It depends on your audience.
Yes.
You know, I mean, if you've read any of the academic, I mean, there's academic tomes on everything. A friend of mine, Dr. Chris Inglis, who I work with, just published a whole academic book on electro-funk.
Right.
You know.
Good luck to
him. And it's all very sort of academic.
And dry as a bone.
And actually, he's a good writer, so it's good. But the point is that these audiences, these books sell for like 150 quid and they sell about 50 copies to people that are writing their PhD thesis on these things. The audience, that piece there, really good, good for me to hear, really making some very interesting, there's very interesting comment in there and sort of theories and frameworks that are underpinning it. But I wonder whether some of these major points that we're trying to get across, some of the things we talked about today around this table, get lost in translation.
Yeah.
Now, the art of great writing for me is
telling stories.
People that can do it with one line, and it's one line that is, you know, like the piece by Dawn.
Yes.
There's a whole subtext to that piece.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's around, you know, if we looked at it from today's perspective, it's about, you know, maleness. It's about maleness as a territory.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, theories and psychologies that relate to the male psyche and so on and so forth. All very hip at the moment, by the way. But the point is that is communicated so well there just through words.
I went to a launch of a book about an artist that a friend of mine had edited. And the first half hour, where they had the microphone of eight people on the stage speaking fluent international art English. And I didn't understand a word they were saying.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, if you go back to the dawn of that kind of writing, when I finally got around to reading the book that was originally titled The Sociology of Rock by Simon Frith.
Yeah.
It was reissued as Sound Effects.
Sure.
I found it incredibly readable and fascinating.
Well, Simon's one of our legends. Been at it a long time and knows how to
walk that line. I'd recommend that book to anyone.
Yeah, of course.
It's certainly not a joyless experience.
No. For casual readers who are interested in the sort of the circus and the froth of pop, a great biography is one that tells you the facts and puts them in context and maybe surfaces a bit of the sort of the grubby underbelly of the whole thing. That's why people buy those things. But if you've got more than a passing interest in it, you know, people around this table, for example, you know, some of the academics, the people I work with, they want to know context. And the context is often a theoretical context about how we see the world. You know, I see the world very differently now to the way I did 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, my mind has been expanded by the things I've read and seen and the times we live in. And I would argue that this recontextualizing of the history. I mean, people have not stopped writing about ancient Greece.
Yeah,
they're still debating, you know, Seneca and kind of the great philosophers. They're still doing it because every generation changes the context.
Yeah.
So we start to look at Greek essentialism as a manifestation of misogyny that's passed on through Freud and so on and so on, and Carl Jung.
It's marvellous.
But do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And people will continue to do that. They're going to do that with flipping Fleetwood Mac. They're going to look at Fleetwood Mac as a discourse around behavioural dynamics.
The essentialism of rumours.
Right.
Yeah.
The essentialist tropes manifest in rumours, a discussion of, you know, post-intersectional theories of whatever. Yeah.
I think
yeah.
on that happy note.
No, yeah, there's, there's one more thing, and it actually does tie in neatly with this, talking about writing styles, because it's about a similarly serious topic, but it's written about in a very different way. This is Catlin Moran writing in The Times in 2007. I need a break. What shall I have? Heroin or a baby? And it's
that's why I love writers. I love writers because they're amazing idiots. They're idiots and genius.
Yeah, but this is a really interesting comparison of Lily Allen and Amy Winehouse. Blimey O'Reilly, what a week for the ladies. One understands why both Winehouse and Allen are vexed at being continually lumped in with and played off and against each other, sighing about sexism and all women looking the same to you. But at the same time, the roughly concurrent launches of their careers and subsequent parallel developments in profile have tied them together in the popular imagination, blah, 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 blah. Not least in this exciting week when Winehouse has been arrested while Lily Allen has announced that she is pregnant. Of course, one doesn't wish to imply that having your first child is in any way an experience comparable to being arrested in connection with an alleged bribery plot. You only get a maximum of 10 years misery for trial fixing, ha ha. But both seem both seem telling conclusions to the lady's extraordinary, frenetic and high-profile years. And it's a flippant piece, right? It's a column in the Times.
Yeah, yeah,
and
it's
making light of something, but also getting quite serious about the impact that fame has had on both of these two women that, of course, in Amy Winehouse's case, we all know it ended tragically. And it does actually get to the heart of the matter, which is, well, what both of them need is essentially a holiday, and what neither of them can get through normal means in this business, in this industry, in this world, with the level of scrutiny that they get as women, is a holiday. And so it's kind of equally sort of deep, even though the tone of it and the style of it and the context of it is a different one to the academic one.
Look inside your tiny mind and look a bit harder, 'cause we're so uninspired, so sick and tired of all the hatred you harbour.
Listen, we've got to wrap up. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
You know, it has been
fabulous.
You guys are amazing, and what you're doing here is amazing.
No,
as I said to you many times before, this will gain momentum as some of the things you were talking about recede into history more. You know, I'm seeing this all around the universities of the UK and abroad, is that they're starting to build real interest in how history can be re-understood.
I take it, shall we just say goodbye now and carry on?
Yes, let's say goodbye.
Let's say goodbye.
Hang on a minute.
Honestly, it was huge fun.
I didn't say goodbye. No, but we didn't. That wasn't a proper goodbye.
Okay.
That was a pathetic
goodbye.
Well, can't goodbye.
Say goodbye to the comedy double act.
This is the Pete.
It's the two Ronnies. It's goodbye from it, but not goodbye from me. We're back in 2 weeks with Lloyd Bradley.
Right, brilliant.
He's coming into his
amazing
books,
writer.
Specifically the anniversary of Sounds Like London,
which is a fantastic book.
So Lloyd will be back in, and really looking forward to seeing him. Cliff Jones, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Barney. Always great.
You know, good luck with all your endeavours, and we'll no doubt be in touch on all kinds of things. But that's it from all of us. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
It's not okay to be gay. Well, I think you're just evil. You're just some racist who can't tie my laces. Your point of view is medieval.
That concludes episode 152 of the Rocks Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Cliff Jones. The hosts were Bonnie Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rocks Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
That's
fine. Prompt. Yeah. This is hugely entertaining. I've missed this. I need to check out the other episodes of you.